Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Julian Tweeten, who talks about her recent article titled, How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left, which reveals how unaccountable tech companies are defining the parameters of acceptable discourse. Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California, who discusses the links between this year's devastating western U.S. wildfires and climate change, and excerpts of a Yale University speech by writer and climate activist Bill McKibben, who warns that while the situation is dire, the global battle against climate change is not over. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
This year's massive outbreak of cholera in war-torn Yemen could lead to 1 million cases of the bacterial disease before the end of the year, the fastest spreading such outbreak in modern history. The epidemic, which began in late April, now surpasses Haiti's cholera outbreak after the massive 2010 earthquake. Yemen is in the midst of a three-year civil war between Houthi rebels and a coalition backed by Saudi Arabia, supplied with U.S.-made weapons. Yemen's director of Save the Children called the cholera epidemic a man-made crisis, where the healthcare system is on the edge of collapse, children go hungry, and people are blocked from getting the medical treatment they need. The World Health Organization has reported more than 815,000 suspected cases of the disease in Yemen and 2,156 deaths thus far. About 4,000 suspected cases are being reported daily, more than half of which are among children under 18 years old. Over the summer, the international community pledged to supply 1 million doses of cholera vaccine to Yemen, but those plans were canceled due to the rapid spread of the disease. Now, the World Health Organization has established rehydration centers across the country, bringing in medical staff and providing cholera kits, which include supplies ranging from water purification tablets to soap and disinfectants. A month after Hurricane Maria tore through Puerto Rico, raw sewage is flowing into rivers and reservoirs which supply water to the island's 3.5 million people. Residents, most still without electricity, don't have clean water for drinking, bathing, and washing clothes. The situation has become so dire that some people have turned to tapping water from known polluted sources, including the Environmental Protection Agency's designated toxic pollution Superfund sites. As nearly half of Puerto Rico's sewage treatment plants are out of service, there is growing concern about an emerging public health crisis, according to the Associated Press. When Puerto Ricans bathe or wash their clothes with contaminated surface water drawn from lakes, rivers, creeks, and springs, they are at risk of becoming infected with bacteria, like leptospirosis, which is caused when drinking water is contaminated with animal urine. Most Puerto Ricans now rely on bottled water and are warned to boil their water from all suspect sources. The current problems in Puerto Rico stem from an aging and inefficient energy infrastructure, dozens of toxic waste sites, and the most contaminated drinking water supply in the U.S. Now, tons of man-made debris and rotting vegetation clog streets and waterways, which threaten to produce a worsening trash and pollution crisis for months to come. About half of the country's 1.6 million prisoners have some sort of job behind bars. Though prisoners technically volunteer to work many of these jobs, nothing is really voluntary in prison. Nationally, prison labor provides many local and county public services. Every state now depends on inmates to clean and prepare meals in prisons. David Fathi of the American Civil Liberties Union's National Prison Project observed, when prisoners are used for cheap labor, there's a risk that our criminal justice policy will be hijacked by a desire to grow or maintain this literally captive labor force. In California, nearly 40% of those fighting dangerous wildfires are state prisoners who volunteered for $2 a day, or $1 an hour if they fought fires on the front lines. In 2014, as California Attorney General Kamala Harris argued in court, the state would lose a critical labor pool if inmates were granted early release due to prison overcrowding. Inmates have few legal protections regarding low-paid work, since they are not covered by minimum wage laws, nor have the right to organize unions. In recent years, prison industries have expanded to make license plates, uniforms, furniture, and engage in telemarketing. Not only does the public and private sector's use of prison labor create a perverse incentive to slow the momentum of prison sentencing reforms, but this push also decreases worker wages in communities, large and small, across America. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As congressional committees and special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation seeks evidence on charges that Donald Trump's presidential campaign had colluded with Russian government operatives to win the White House, independent journalism has emerged as an unlikely victim of the probe. An explosion of news stories highlighting charges that Russia sponsored an operation to plant fake news in U.S. social media in order to boost Trump during the 2016 election campaign has prompted online giants Google and Facebook to block access to what they label as offensive news websites. Unfortunately, dozens of progressive, left, and radical political websites have been blocked in this process and have since reported dramatic declines in their online traffic, the lifeblood of online news organizations. This marginalization of left media resulted in large part from major changes made to Google's search engine algorithm, designed, the company says, to combat fake news. Your reporter spoke with Julian Tweeten, who writes about the intersection of the technology industry and socioeconomic topics. Here she discusses important issues examined in her recent article titled "How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left," which reveals how unaccountable tech companies are defining the parameters of acceptable discourse.
The kind of premise of what I wrote is that there's this kind of confluence of the fake news narrative and of the Russiagate narrative. And the idea is that, you know, various kind of mainstream media sources, CNN, The Washington Post, New York Times, et cetera, have been really emphasizing the influence of Russia on, you know, the election, obviously. And in the process of kind of this narrative of Russian tampering with United States democracy, various technology companies have been kind of placed at the center. So Facebook, Google, Twitter, which all have tremendous capacity to disseminate information and to disseminate news stories. And so what's been going on kind of more recently, many pundits and kind of mainstream media sources are claiming that Russia has been tampering with Facebook and with Twitter. Russian agents have placed ads on Facebook and have created accounts on Twitter that have manipulated American citizens and the American voting citizenry. So that's kind of the latest development in this narrative. But what I found was that the idea of fake news is very nebulous. Since Google and Facebook have kind of been responding to these critiques of their complicity in disseminating fake news, left-leaning sites have suffered. So Google has updated its algorithms in order to kind of, quote, control for the spread of fake news. And in the process, sites like Alternet and the World Socialist website and Democracy Now! And several others have been found have seen their search traffic decline. And so that's kind of the latest, again, the latest stirring in the ongoing fake news and kind of Russiagate narrative.
Julianne, can you explain a little bit more about the algorithm changes that we've seen at Facebook and how that has affected? And you can mention some of the statistics of the reduced readership that some of these important progressive sites have experienced as a result of that algorithm change.
That's actually more closely related to Google. In April, Google instituted several algorithmic updates in response specifically to accusations that it had helped to spread misinformation and quote, fake news. And as a result of that, various sites saw their search traffic decline. So the World Socialist website reported that it had seen a 67% decrease in traffic between April and July of this year. So right after the algorithms were changed, a total decrease of 85%. Sites like Alternet, Democracy Now!, Common Dreams, and Global Research and Truthout also saw pretty significant declines in their search traffic, ranging from 49% to 71%. And Alternet claimed to have lost an average of 1.2 million of its 2.7 million unique visitors that it received from search traffic. And of course, Google has a search monopoly and generates the majority of search traffic for most websites. So it's pretty easily attributable to Google searches. So it's quite indicative of the power that Google can have on pretty much any website it wants, let alone one with a certain political identity.
These progressive media outlets, small, not very powerful, they are quite alarmed at what's going on here in the real reduction of their readership. What are they doing to push back? Are they capable of putting any counter pressure here to get back on some kind of even playing field in social media without being hobbled by these counter fake news operations?
Right. It's difficult for them because they are, you know, they're not in positions of power, certainly not compared to the monopolistic forces that provide their search rankings or present them to users on a large scale. I don't know exactly what the strategy is, but, you know, I think this speaks much more to a very, very large scale problem, which is monopoly capitalism. The fact that there are these private companies that have their own political motivations that play such a large role in how visible these sites can be. Perhaps some of these sites can take legal action. I think they're maybe more apt to try to organize in a more grassroots fashion. Again, I'm not entirely sure. I wish I knew more about that. But I do think that this should be used as an opportunity to really examine the effects of monopoly capitalism and of you know, giving such a small concentration of companies such immense power when so much is at stake.
That was journalist Julian Tweeten, who wrote the article titled "How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left," published by In These Times magazine. Find links to Tweeten's article and related material by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The early October wildfires that swept six Northern California counties, including Napa, Lake, Sonoma, Mendocino, Butte, and Solano, constitute the deadliest fires in California history. Officials reported that multiple blazes across the state killed 42 people and hospitalized nearly 200 others. The wildfires destroyed at least 8,400 homes and other structures and burned more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. An estimated 5,000 firefighters continue to battle 10 different fires across Northern California. Altogether, 100,000 people were displaced by the fires, leaving thousands of evacuees not knowing if they'll be able to find new homes in the region in the months and years ahead. All told, this year's California fires caused the largest loss of life due to fire in the U.S. since Minnesota's Cloquet Fire in 1918. Since the 1970s and early 80s, the number of large wildfires has increased more than 500% in federally managed forests across the western U.S. Questions are now being raised by many about why there's been such a dramatic rise in wildfires in recent years. According to scientists, the answer is climate change, in combination with other factors. Your reporter spoke with Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California at Merced. Here he explains how climate change has increased the frequency and destructive power of wildfires, and will make the future incidents of these fires ever more dangerous.
So across the western United States, there has been a very dramatic increase overall in wildfire since the 1970s. Every decade since then has seen more fire, more large fires, more area burned in those fires, more high severity fires in places that didn't used to get high severity fire that frequently. every decade. The thing to keep in mind is that there's a lot of diversity in the ecosystems and fire in those ecosystems within the West. So some places are much more sensitive to changes in temperature than others are. Now, these fires that we're talking about in California most recently, Sonoma and Napa counties in particular, are burning in a different kind of vegetation. So it's lower elevation, doesn't snow there. It's much warmer and drier in the summer. And so the temperatures that we've had are compounding this, but there's a lot more going on than just the temperatures. This last winter was a very wet winter, and that gave us a lot of extra fuel, but it was also very hot temperatures in the spring and into the summer. And so those fuels dried out and were available to burn the same year that they grew. At the same time, we had a record drought in California for several years. Fuels are really super dry. There's more fuel than usual on the landscape. And we had these winds, and we always have plenty of ignition. And that gave us this really, you know, combustible situation. And then a lot of homes have been built in these subdivisions that are right up against dense chaparral, so shrubland, fuels, grasses, and things like that as well. That mix of homes and really dense fuels and then the really dry conditions can give you a really risky situation all the way around.
I would ask you, Leroy, to comment on something you had written. You had written that these very destructive wildfires we're seeing are not a natural occurrence, and you link them with climate change. How do we know it's climate change that's feeding this pattern of ever-increasing and more severe fires?
The important thing to keep in mind around the Western U.S., well, and globally, is that when we're looking at fire, we're not thinking of fire as a way to prove that climate change is happening. We know climate change is happening because we know about the basic physics of what we're doing to the atmosphere. We know how we change the content of the atmosphere, increasing concentration of greenhouse gases. You know, there would be no life on Earth. Earth would not be warm enough to support the ecosystems that we have without the greenhouse effect. What we've done is intensify that, and so now the temperature of the Earth is catching up, and that's affecting ecosystems. It's that energy imbalance that we've introduced by changing the atmosphere has affected the climate system as a whole. It's warming up Earth, and there are a lot of feedbacks. And fire is one of those feedbacks. Fire allows us to see some of the impacts very abruptly of climate change on the landscape. So as you warm things up gradually over time, you still get very abrupt changes in the landscape in sort of steps from fire, from insect infestations, and from drought dieback and things like that. So these are natural processes, but they're sort of like a natural way the system responds as it's transformed by climate change.
We have a government in Washington right now, both the Congress and in the White House and the Trump administration, a lot of climate deniers in charge of key agencies that have a lot to do with fighting fires and providing resources to prepare for the next set of fires next season. How is the climate change denial in our government hobbling and placing obstacles for those who are really concerned about it and trying to do their best to combat these fires before they start?
With the current administration, it's hard to see how they are responsive to the science that would tell you what to do, where, and when to get the results that you want to get. So we have a lot of trepidation that policies are going to be enacted to manage the landscape that don't take account of the science that tells us what their effects are going to be. We've had these problems in the past, and if we do it again at this time, this moment in our history, we're just going to be compounding the risk that we face and the difficulty that we're going to have in the future to manage these landscapes in a way that provides the services we want from them.
That was Leroy Westerling, co-director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute at the University of California at Merced. For more information on the links between Western U.S. wildfires and climate change, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Writer and activist Bill McKibben spoke at Yale University on October 10th, addressing the urgency of taking action to slow down climate chaos. In the wake of many recent disasters predicted by climate scientists, including the deadliest forest fires in California history, and three of the strongest hurricanes ever to hit the U.S. mainland and Caribbean, McKibben talked about the pace of climate change and the people's and politicians' response to it. McKibben wrote The End of Nature in 1988, the first book for non-scientists that explained the concept of climate change. He later co-founded the group 350.org, which has led a global campaign to raise awareness about the impacts of climate change, especially on poor nations and low-lying islands whose people have contributed the least to create the climate crisis. McKibben now travels the world, raising the alarm about the dire consequences of climate change and urging people to take immediate action to reverse it. During his talk at Yale, he pointed out that although coal plants are being phased out and renewable energy sources are growing by leaps and bounds, the planet is not winning the battle fast enough and hence is losing ground. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus recorded McKibben's Yale speech, titled simply Too Hot, The Desperate Science and Politics of Climate, and brings us the following excerpts.
There is resistance underway every place around the world now, as I say, and it's beautiful to watch, and it comes from everywhere. So much leadership provided by frontline communities, and especially, I think most gratifyingly over the last 5 years, by this rapid emergence to the leadership of indigenous traditions around the world. You saw what happened at Standing Rock last autumn, a beautiful, beautiful, powerful gathering. It didn't surprise me because the people who organized it, we've been working with for years, they are great leaders. It's a good sign that the oldest, I was saying this to someone at lunch, that the oldest wisdom tradition on the planet, indigenous wisdom tradition, is meshing now powerfully with the newest, that the word that comes from the sweat lodge and the word that comes from the supercomputer is the same word about what we need to be doing, okay? And now people gather in their numbers. You know, these were 400,000 people on the march in New York City a couple of years ago. Until the Women's March at the beginning of January, the biggest marches about anything in this country in a very long time. And it wasn't just in this country, it was, as usual, all over the entire world. You know, there are sort of tropes that go on in one's, that fit the human mind, our image of, and one of them is the battle of the small against the very large, okay? The David and Goliath story. These are our friends in the Pacific, in those islands like Vanuatu and Tuvalu and the Marshalls and Micronesia and the Solomons that'll probably be underwater by the end of the century. But boy, people, their slogan is, we are not drowning, we are fighting, and boy, they are. When we were marching in New York, they'd cut down on each island a single tree and made a big traditional war canoe, and they took them to Newcastle in the Pacific, which is the biggest coal port in the world, and there they used them for a day to blockade that port and keep the largest ore ships in the world in harbor so they couldn't come out without running them over. It was a brave and beautiful action. It's been one of the reasons that's things that galvanized Australians into opposing this crazy plan for this giant coal mine. And it illustrated perfectly this trope, the small and the many against the few and the very big. We saw the same image from the Pacific Northwest the next year. This was when Shell Oil announced that they were going to go drill for oil in the Arctic. Think about that for 1 minute, by the way, okay? Scientists had said, if you warm the planet, the Arctic will melt. Shell Oil and its ilk paid no attention and went ahead, and what do you know, the Arctic melted. Having looked at that, did the leadership of Shell Oil say, huh, maybe we should go into the solar business instead, this seems not to be working out? No. The leadership of Shell Oil said, hey, it's melted up there now, it will be easier to drill for more oil. in Seattle and in Portland. For days, they blockaded the two giant drilling rigs with small craft. We called them kayaktivists, okay? And it was beautiful. And it threatened brand damage to Shell that was more than they could contend with. And by the end of the year, Shell said, well, we didn't find enough oil in the Arctic, we're going home. Really, what they'd found was far more trouble than they could deal with. And so they turned tail and ran, and that was a very good moment. But we need lots more moments like that. The planet is now way, way outside its comfort zone. That's what it means when the Arctic is melting, when coral is dying. Because it is way, way outside its comfort zone, we need to be outside our comfort zones too. We need to be doing much more than we are doing now, because it is manifest that what we are doing now is insufficient. That's why the temperature keeps going up. All we are asking for is a world a little bit like the one that we were born onto, a little bit of ice at the top and the bottom, the odd coral reef in the middle. That's not a radical demand. That is a conservative demand. Radicals work at all companies. If you get up in the morning willing to make your fortune by altering the chemical composition of the atmosphere, and you are willing to do it after scientists have told you what will happen, and if you're willing to keep doing it after you've seen it happening, then you are a radical in a way we have not had on this planet before, and our job is to check that radicalism. And it is our job. And it is our job to check it fast.
That was Bill McKibben, writer, climate activist, and co-founder of the climate change group, 350.org. Learn more about climate change issues, 350.org, and Bill McKibben by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.